Ladies and gentlemen, so it's Andrew Jenks, and we are now kicking off a new 12-episode sort of series similar to What Really Happened. It's called the What Really Happened interview series, produced by Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Danny Garcia, Brian Gewirtz, Cadence 13, and Seven Bucks Productions. I'm going to be interviewing a wide range of people about kind of a specific moment in their lives and what really happened. Sometimes it'll veer into broader topics. I have interviewed and will be interviewing everyone from General Stanley McChrystal, Academy Award winners, Matt Heineman, Andrew Stanton, to a cognitive scientist who had the most popular TED Talk of 2018 and a linguistics expert, Lyra Boroditsky, and Suki Kim, who wrote, I think, like, I don't know, one of the best books I've ever read about going undercover in North Korea. She's the first and only journalist to have done so. So these are an additional 12 episodes. Thanks to all of you for listening to the podcast. Here is a preview of what's to come.
Hey, this is Andrew Jenks. I'm excited to announce our What Really Happened interview series.
Guests will include cognitive scientist Lyra Boroditsky.
All of us have this sense that, you know, we can just go to the tape. We even have that expression, let's go to the tape.
Right.
Because you think if we can go to the video, we can see the video, we'll see reality with our eyes. But that's not actually how we arrive at our judgment.
Retired 4-star General Stanley McChrystal.
Hey, General McChrystal.
Please call me Stan.
This may be too personal, but if you have nightmares.
When it happens, I wake up and I'm bothered. The common factor is I'm at a point where suddenly I'm helpless. And I try to think if there's something in my life that has triggered it. That's, to me, maybe the most frightening feeling of all.
New York Times bestselling author Suki Kim.
Well, a part of doing undercover work is not asking questions in case you get stopped. The only way to write about it was to live inside among North Koreans. That was my single goal. And this opportunity was going to allow me that. If they lie all the time, which they did, my students did, you can call that a lie or you can try to understand why they do it.
Award-winning filmmaker Andrew Stanton.
You know, you've won 2 Academy Awards. It's become known as the biggest box office flop in history, but
that's the sad part for me. It's like, wow, like we really didn't prepare ourselves to not see each other again. This is the honest truth. I said, if I can't handle reading bad reviews, then I shouldn't be reading good reviews. And I've never read anything ever since.
Oh, come on.
No, I mean it.
People say that.
No, I mean it.
This is the What Really Happened interview series. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Today is our first interview, which I did with the great Aaron Lee Carr live on stage at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. Aaron is one of my favorite documentary filmmakers, and she has done some incredible work in the true crime space. Documentaries like Mommy, Dead and Dearest, an HBO film, as well as Thought Crimes, The Case of Cannibal Cop. And more recently, she just premiered at South by I Love You, Now Die, The Commonwealth versus Michelle Carter, which is the story of the teenage girl. You probably remember the story. The teenage girl who went to prison for encouraging her boyfriend, Conrad, to commit suicide. Doing so, at least we were told, through text messages encouraging him to do it. And the documentary is up there in terms of my favorite documentaries ever. It should win a slew of awards, but more importantly, demonstrates the nuance in a story like this. And it's just true crime done right, which we really get into what true crime is, the future of that genre. And so this is our first interview for the What Really Happened interview series with Aaron Lee Carr.
Hey, guys. Hi. Welcome to South By.
So can you actually, why don't you, I was going to describe the movie and it would take me probably 20 minutes to describe it because I'm blah, 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 blah. How would you, what is the movie about? Y'all probably remember the movie. What happened. What's the story that we were all told and what does your movie kind of get into?
Absolutely. So Michelle Carter was a teenage girl who loved texting on her phone, the way that she, like all young women, do. Unfortunately, her boyfriend at the time, Conrad Roy, was suicidally ideating and was struggling with mental health issues. And instead of saying, I'm going to get you help and telling other people about what happened, she kept their conversations to herself and then basically started telling him over and over again to kill himself. And so she went to trial for, she was charged with involuntary manslaughter, and HBO commissioned the film, and I had a camera inside the courtroom. And basically the film is about what we think happened between those two people and what really happened and sort of the discovery in between.
And so when watching the film, I am at certain points convinced that she should go to prison for life. And then 30 minutes later, I'm convinced she absolutely should not. I mean, it goes back and forth. One of the great things about the film is you have access. And I think it's true with your other two films as well. You get incredible access. In this case, you have everyone from the parents to the police to the journalist that seemed like the main journalist that was focusing on the case. With documentaries, how important is access? Do you think you would have made that movie if you didn't have those key characters to help tell the story?
Yeah, I think that the movie is the greatest part because those are the people that said yes to me. So many people said no to me. And I think as a documentary filmmaker, that my main job is getting you on the phone and begging you to talk to me. And so I think that you start with off the records and I tell them about me and my process. And I think that my first two films, one being Thought Crimes and two being Mommy, Dead and Dearest, which played at South By in 2017. I said that I tend to really want to give an empathic response to these crime stories. I want to find out what happened here. And so, I don't know, but I didn't get, access to Michelle, and it's a two-part HBO series, and credit to HBO for being like, you don't have to have the main person to what I hope is a really complex retelling of the events that took place.
What was it like to, you've made three movies with HBO. I remember my first movie, HBO bought, and I remember I couldn't believe it because they didn't give me, everyone was like, when you go in and meet with Sheila Nevins, she's going to give you a laundry list of notes. So I went in and I was nervous and I had my notepad and my pencil and I'm freaking out. And she comes in, I've told her this story. She lays down.
Yep.
She has a Diet Coke or something, puts her feet up and is like, this movie's pretty good. I think we can air it. And I'm like, what,
it's just the most beautiful thing you've ever heard.
And well, fuck yeah. And then I also I found that to be the case with a lot of outlets that are very secure with themselves. So this podcast is produced by Cadence 13 and 7 Bucks Productions. Both of them who are like at the top of the top aren't always trying to tell me what the story is. They kind of trust you. Has that been, that was a very leading question, but do you find that to be the case with HBO?
I mean, am I so good that I don't get notes? Thanks, Andrew. No. I think that we all have a Sheila story, and like my Sheila story.
And sorry, really, I'm
Sheila
already interrupting.
Nevins,
yeah.
That is the, basically the executive producer at HBO, was there for 40 years, is called like the grand mistress of documentary. She's like one of the biggest reasons why any of us have jobs.
Before anyone was commissioning documentaries, Sheila was doing it, 20 films a year or something. So anyway,
and talking about sex and complicated women and like doing anything from Real Sex to Cat House to Paradise Lost. I mean, the things that I studied in order to become a documentary filmmaker, she was at the helm of greenlighting. And so when I met Sheila, I tried to pitch her something on the dark web. And she's like, that's boring. No, thank you.
She's very good at that too.
And I kind of just kept talking. And when you guys are in rooms with people and talking with people about your ideas, one of the things that I like to bring up is have about 10 ideas. Because early in the process, somebody can shoot you down. But if you have other things to pitch, they'll remember your resourcefulness. And I know that this is not a show about pitching, but it's a story about making things and like discovering things and investigating things. So I had a couple of other ideas. And Sheila said, I don't like your ideas, but I like you. And I was like, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. So kind of the similar. And she has not given me a ton of notes.
You know, you said that part of your process at first, you said something about off the record, which got me thinking. You're a documentary filmmaker. Do you consider yourself a journalist?
I do, but with the caveat of journalists don't add music and don't cut things in the way. Like, I think that, you know, when you're watching any of these movies or your movies, like, I think an audience can take away sort of what we feel about things. And there's many forms of journalism, but my dad was this incredible journalist, David Carr for the New York Times and loved South By. And, you know, he didn't add music to his stuff.
Right.
So I think we do something a little different, but I'm very investigative in my approach and in my process.
Yeah, I'm always hesitant. Like I actually say no, I'm not, because I feel like I have too much respect for journalists or someone like your father. Like, I need music to be able to give. Like, I need the music. I'm manipulating footage to tell my story. Like, manipulation is part of the game, not necessarily in a bad way. Where do you think documentaries are going in the next like 5-10 years? Do you ever think about that? Like, something that I've noticed is when I first made my first documentary, maybe like 10 years ago, when you're hanging out with friends or what have you, it wasn't like a cool thing. And now it was like, oh, documentaries. And the first question was usually like, so how do you make a living? And now documentaries, people are like, oh my God, I was just on Netflix and I saw this and that. And then I'm like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. I haven't seen that. And it's almost like the cool kids are into it, which I'm not used to. Where do you see the genre going in the future? Because in a lot of ways, it's still in its very early stages, I think.
I mean, I feel really excited about it. It is the golden time to be making documentary films, but I don't think that that will leave us, because what we're dealing with is incredibly smart audiences, and watching docs is about gathering information. Like, you're watching a documentary on the Fyre Festival because you want to be a part of the conversation, but also because you're learning things about privilege, about wealth, about grift. I think that in the way that people used to, you know, and still read long form Atlantic pieces to be like, you know, I want to talk about this because I read something. I think that that's what docs are about, but now it's easy to watch. And it's like, you know, there's not a huge barrier. Like, you go on Netflix and there's, you know, Wild Wild Country. Like, that is incredible cinema.
Yeah.
But I'm also learning about identity and about religion. And like, we are in the age of where people are making things that tell us without, you know, hitting us over the head with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's like, but I feel that way about podcasting too. Like, I listen to so many podcasts. I listen to so much Audible. Like, I'm constantly taking information, which actually helps informing my work, because like, I was watching Werner Herzog's Masterclass. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you have to be a soldier of cinema. And like, I was just like, I'm sure. And he's like, you know, don't be a nitwit, read some books. And so it's just like, you know, we're going to take all of these things in. It's ultimately going to inform how we make.
Mm-hmm. With Michelle Carter, how did you, I was watching it and singing a lot of things, but one thing I was thinking about is the editing process, because how many text messages went back and forth between her and her boyfriend?
Around 10,000.
So 10,000 text messages. I mean, I don't even know what that kind of means. Like, I'm trying to think of how, I'm not trying to even joke around. Like, trying to think of how many texts I, is there a way to quantify?
I pick up my phone 225 times a day.
You have the app that tells you that.
Right. And so if we all were to pick, like, look at our usage reports on our phones, like, you know, we think 10,000 is like sort of outside the realm of possibility, but like, we are completely and totally addicted to our phones.
So in the editing process, I think that editors tend to make or break a documentary. The like really cheesy example for me or analogy would be if you give a chef the finest foods, but the chef doesn't know how to cook very well, then it doesn't matter what you give them. It's the meal is going to suck. If you give a really great chef, even food that isn't that great, they can still make something. And if you think of footage like that, I've seen editors take some footage that I've shot that's not very good, and they whip up something and you're like, holy like, that's unbelievable. What is the, what was the editing process like for you, where you're going through a lot of interviews, all of that courtroom footage that you shot, and then all these text messages?
So I think Andrew is completely right. Basically, for documentaries, an editor is like a second director, and the casting of an editor is the most important decision that I'm going to make when I'm doing a project. And so Andrew Kaufman, who's the editor of I Love You Now Die, he cut my last two films. And, you know, he, we have sort of like, I'm like, do you want a script? Do you want to sit down and talk about things? And he's like, no. You know, like, he's not as charmed by me as some people. But we have this, like, you know, he just, he understands tension and pacing, and I trust him. It's my job to go out into the world and get the story and then to trust him. I think that if I were to edit that movie, I don't know if we'd be sitting here talking about it. I think that you need to, I own up to what things I'm good at, right, and the things that I'm not good at. And I've tried editing things before, and it's just like, no, that is not good. But in like another example, I have At the Heart of Gold, which is going to be on HBO May 3rd. It's inside the USA Gymnastics scandal. And the editor, Andrew, wasn't available to cut it because he was cutting one of my movies.
I was
going to
say, yeah.
And so I was like, oh, I'm so nervous to work with someone else. And I ended up, I don't know if she wants me to say her name, but she'll be in the sort of press notes. But she actually had me send her footage to make sure I knew what I was doing, like I could interview people. She was like, yeah, like if I'm gonna sign up for a year of my life with you, I wanna know you can do it.
Yep.
So I was just like, you know, impressed with that. Like,
You have to be confident in who you are as a storyteller with the right editors. I had an editor for Dream Killer about Ryan Ferguson, who went to prison for a murder based on someone else's dream. And we had one more interview with his dad, and the editor, Sam Lee, said, I need to go do the interview.
Ooh.
And I said, all right. And we went, and I was in the back, in the closet with headphones.
Did it seem like someone going on a date with your girlfriend?
Kind of. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like
that.
Sure. I was trying to think of what the joke would be to that, but I don't have one. Shit, it was a layup. So that's editing.
It's just trusting somebody to date your girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about therapy.
Yeah, we're on a couch. There's a fluffy pillow between us.
Yeah, you're in some dark, I think safe to say, correct me if I'm wrong, some dark worlds that you're filming, like. I'll make some movies here and there that are at least inspirational, so I feel good about life. You know, and I'm like, all right, things are good, people are good, humanity's good. You're doing, like, cannibal cop, like, guy who's dreaming about having sex and murdering people. Another one about, you know, they're dark. How do you not, and I'm being more serious here, how does that not consume you? That's been a problem that I had, especially in my 20s, was it never left my brain. And so it led to me going down some pretty dark places. How are you able to kind of turn it off when you're making a documentary and things are always happening? There's always work to be done.
Yeah, I think that. So my dad mentored me and he said, find a beat and get really good at it. And that is what I have done when it comes to complicated crime stories. But then you're right. Then you're at this intersection of people's extreme mental health issues during the worst moment of their lives.
Right.
And I'm here with a goddamn camera in your face.
Right.
And so I think that it, in terms of like actually dealing with it, I mean, yeah, like lost relationships, people are like, this is all I talk about. And I think that as a partner, that would get pretty boring.
Yeah, I've been told.
The undateables, no. And so go to therapy. I pet a lot of dogs on the street. I think that's the thing that I say the most. Can I pet your dog?
Oh, you're not kidding.
No.
Oh, wow.
I just go up to random dogs and say like, hey, what's up? I'm going to pet you on the head. And just having a moment.
You go up to people a lot. You said earlier that you go in the subway and you if people are playing music out loud, or if people are kissing on the subway, you tell them to please stop.
I just like, leave it for later. I don't want to be involved in it. And so what my therapist and I discussed, that's what I always want to be saying on stage, but was like, she's like, don't watch that stuff at night. Stop, you know, you're engaging. I basically studied suicide for 2 years while making this film. And she said, you need to give your brain a break at night.
Right.
Don't go home and rewatch Paradise Lost for the 8th time.
Right.
Like you need to have, so now it's just like 30 Rock, Gilmore Girls, Sex in the City.
Yep.
Like it's just like Goof's Palooza. And,
but for real, you're not kidding.
Like it's just like, it's on repeat. Oh, the Great British Bake Off. I know that everyone has probably seen this, but it's like, I'm a sober woman. It is like taking a Xanax and like floating into the beautiful British world of baking. Like, I don't care about baking. I don't know much about British people. And like, it's just like, you just sort of like lean back and it's, I don't know. It's an incredible.
But whatever, it does the trick. So at a certain hour, do you kind of, it's like, all right, it's 9 p.m. I got a
time for British Bake Off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, right now, because I'm putting 2 movies and a book out, I work till midnight, but that'll only be for the next 2 months.
What about all the ideas I assume you have? Because it seems like you're following current events. Your documentaries have focused on people or things that have been in the news. And then what's, if I don't say so myself, brilliant about you is you find all of the layers of nuance in these stories that we're convinced we know of and we've heard about, talked at length, and you kind of bring in all these different elements that we haven't thought of. Are you, do you have like do you have a list of all of million different stories that are going on that you're interested in and then it kind of slowly pares down? Or how does your process work in terms of finding stories?
Yeah, I mean, I do what's called stacking. And so as a
stacking,
yeah, like as a freelancer, I'm not tied to one organization. I'm very lucky to make things for HBO and for Netflix. But when you're covering crime cases, it's really about sort of like, is this one dimensional two or is it three? Because in order to make things for HBO, it has to be three dimensional. It can't just be about, you know, texting and loneliness. It has to be, you know, like with the Glee elements and things like that. So I used to get very nervous. Like, is this idea HBO worthy? Like, is it, you know, is it not? And so I think that I have Google alerts set up for things. I check Twitter and Reddit every day. Now I have like, you know, a woman who helps me sleuth for things that are in our sort of Venn diagram. But I never have things that are in production at the same time. I'll have a ton of different ideas, but the way that you end up not doing well is if you have too many things from production and then the quality of the work goes down. And like, I want to continue making things, but the quality has to stay at a certain level if I want to be with, you know, the big gals or the big boys.
True crime, I think, is, I'm really sensitive to it because I think you're dealing with, to your point, you're dealing with, and this is something that I think I often forget when watching someone else's film, you're dealing with families who have lost loved ones. You're dealing with families who've realized that their family member is guilty of some sort of horrendous crime. And I've always had a really tough time with 48 Hours and Dateline and those shows because to me, they, and I'm not saying I'm right, just my opinion, they add this sort of sexy,
It's the one-dimensional storytelling, I was saying.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, like it's like you as a filmmaker are about nuance and insight, and they have to be done so quickly that there's not going to be a lot of high-level thoughts about it. And like, listen, like I like a Dateline like everybody likes a Dateline. It's like easy, but then I forget it. And I don't want to be a person that's a hater. But I think that I think that those people tend to forget that this is not entertainment for us. These are people's lives. And I think that, you know, I just think that it just is important to recognize that when you're making things about real people, like it just, these things matter in how you treat them.
And like you said, not wanting to be a hater per se, there are great journalists at those shows. Aaron Moriarty at 48 Hours that do exceptional work and know what they're doing. They're just kind of limited in terms of what their show is.
Yeah, there's a Michelle Carter, 48 Hours.
There you go.
And I think that it would be really interesting to do a side-by-side comparison.
Right.
Yeah. Hmm.
How familiar do you become with the law? Like, I think you do a really good job of not, we don't get lost in the legality of it all, which I know when I'm making films and or stories in the true crime space, boy, is the law complicated. And there are a lot of fancy words that a college dropout like me doesn't understand, and a lot of time spent with lawyers understanding, you know, when they're saying you can't include this because it's going to screw my client because of this reason, and that they actually that actually might not be the case, and you find yourself arguing with some Harvard law grad, and you don't really. How familiar do you become with, like, do you read the entire court transcripts? I mean, I know in the Michelle Carter case, it sounds like you were actually there. You were there for the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, I basically got a super, you know, got to know Sue Correa, who's the clerk magistrate of the judge, and got to know the court officer, Marianne. Like, for me, it was like, okay, who are these people? What are their roles in this environment? And, you know, how do they feel? And I didn't end up filming either those two people, but they really helped decode some of these sort of more complex things that I just didn't understand. And, you know, reading through the legal documents, like I just, you know, I would go through all of it and, you know, do a careful reading and then do another one. And I'm really lucky to work with Andrew Rossi, my producer, you know, who has a law degree. And
I didn't think of that.
So it's just...
get a producer who's a lawyer.
You know, and I think that...
And being serious, for real though, does he help in that?
Yeah.
He helps big time.
I mean, he helps decode in the same way because what I see in documentaries are is like they're translating.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, we get to have these really great back and forths where we're having the discussion, but what we do is like you find the smartest people in the room and you attach yourself to them and that's your team. And if you are the smartest person in your group, you know, then you're doing something wrong.
Yeah. There's that quote. If you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Yeah. Like, so it's just, I think that's been a continual sort of like, a guide to how I make things. I'm not intimidated by other people's smarts or if they challenge me, challenge is good.
It requires a little bit of ego, no?
Yes. Being a director is being a delusional weirdo.
Yeah. That's a quote. Imagine a case like this, a double murder trial, a high-profile media circus, a famous celebrity accused of the crime, and then a not guilty verdict. Now imagine 8 years later. What happens when there's a new murder with the same celebrity suspect and a second chance to get justice? Did he do it again? And this time, can she prove it? From the mind of executive producer Marcia Clark comes a new murder mystery only she could tell. It's about what goes on outside the court and beyond the TV cameras. It's about the battle fought in the public eye and what really goes on behind the scenes. And no one knows that better than Marcia Clark. By the end of the 10 episodes, you'll know the truth, but they'll keep you guessing until the very last minute. The Fix. A 10-episode event premiering Monday, March 18th on ABC. What about interviews in prison? I was watching your film the other day with, Gypsy.
Yeah.
Gypsy.
Yeah.
And she's there, she's giving the interview, handcuffed. How do you approach, let's take that example. If you could just give a quick,
sure.
You know, about that story and then how you go about approaching an interview like that.
Gypsy Rose is a young woman who for the majority of her life was wheelchair handicapped. And they said that she had muscular dystrophy and she was very close with her mother, Dee Dee Blanchard. And they looked like this perfect family. They went to Disney together. They just were this little mom-daughter duo. But Gypsy's head was shaved. Her teeth were falling out. She had these big glasses. And there were a couple of people that sort of were like questioning this. And so Gypsy, when she became 17, she didn't really know her age. She was like, I want to have a boyfriend. Like, I want to know what love is. She loved Disney movies. And so she got an online boyfriend from ChristianDatingForFree.com. And unfortunately, they plotted together to murder her mother because her mother was pretending something about Gypsy's illness and who she was. And so it's this weird, I think like Roger Ebert, one of my favorite quotes, RogerEbert.com said it was like a Russian nesting doll of horror where it kept on, like you thought the horror was there and then it'd become another horror, become another horror, become another horror.
Because they were telling the world, the mother at least was saying, my daughter's sick, and they were getting free things, right?
Yeah,
and going all different places. Okay, and then they.
But she forced her into a wheelchair in public.
That's
to get a Disney trip.
Right,
like she can't go to school. Like that is not worth it at all.
It was abuse. It was
the most horrific child abuse I'd ever witnessed.
Right, and so you're going in there. How do you conduct that interview? How do you conduct that interview?
So Gypsy Rose, and I hope you guys watch the movie. It's available on HBO.
Or iTunes,
thank you. And she had just pled guilty, and the judge said, we're going to allow you to film the interview in the courtroom, but you only have 2 hours.
That, right.
And she came in, and she was handcuffed. And I was like, okay, like, let's take the handcuffs off. And they're like, no, the handcuffs stay on. And she was like, I mean, she's like 110 pounds soaking wet. Like, and then there was no hot water in the prison. And so her hair was all fucked up. And she's like, I'm feeling really embarrassed about my hair. Do you have a bobby pin? And then I have to go ask the bailiff, can I use a bobby pin out of my crazy hair and put it in her crazy hair so she feels more comfortable?
You got some hair.
And, you know, it was horrifying. She was really uncomfortable. I was really uncomfortable, but we'd spent so much time on the phone and I met with her in person a couple of times and developed a rapport. So I just said, I know that this is painful. I know you would like to look a different way. Mm. We're going to talk about this and I'm going to make sure you feel heard. And so we ended up using the full 2 hours. And, you know, I think that I remember like I was coming back from the airport and I was like looking at the footage and I already was figuring out like how we should cut it. And I've never done that with any other thing. Like I've been so like, oh my God, I'm so tired. I'm not going to look at the footage. We're going to look at it later. But I was so thrilled that we actually got it. Mm. And I felt like it was a true conversation that I just couldn't wait to watch it.
Yeah. It comes across that way. You know, something that I think a lot of documentary filmmakers that I admire do, and everyone does it a different way, I'm curious how you do it, is you got to build trust with the people that you're filming.
But then we abandon them.
Well, so that's interesting. Do you feel that you abandon them?
I mean, I think that I find it really difficult because a film is all about rapport and understanding and like, you know, speaking together as humans. And then I have to go make my next thing. And I have found that I think it's really painful for people to be the apple of my eye or somebody else's eye. And then, you know, you put the movie out, you do the publicity for it, people talk to you about it, and then it's sort of over. And these are people who have normal lives, and this was like a kind of a special thing where they felt listened to and special, and in the same way that I feel special when I make something.
Yeah.
And so I've been trying to really think about and think critically, what is a way for me to have an understanding with someone and develop a rapport, but not have them feel like we're friends, because we're not. And I think I want to get better and better at my job, that I am never misleading and people don't ever feel abandoned.
Yeah.
So it's a work in progress.
What, I've done this in the past where there was one family I was following that was a little bit hesitant and I really cared about their story. So I flew down to Missouri with my film crew, but we didn't film anything. And we sat down first with the mom and had lunch. Then the next evening had dinner with the father. And then they were like, so where are the cameras? And I said, we just wanted you to get to know us because I think I'm a nice guy. I think these are nice people. Like we're well-intentioned. And
does that feel real or does it in some way, is it a little manipulative?
I think I totally understand how people would find it manipulative. And I respect that. But I don't think it is because my intent is to make a movie. I'm very forthright about that. But I also want them to trust me. The other thing that I do with everyone, including people that I know, I shouldn't say I know, but there's a chance they may not look good. And I've done this for a while now, is I give them, when I first meet them, I give them my cell phone number. And I say, while we're filming, after we're filming, when the movie's out, 10 years from now, this is my number, call me and I'll pick up the phone. If I don't, I'll call you back. And
that's great. And I think that's really smart and important.
And but because you're right, there's a guilty component where I'm making a living off of your tragedies. And I don't know if there's anything that can kind of make up for that, so to speak, but there's ways
But I think for me, it was like figuring out and putting myself through that rigorous awareness. Like, am I going to, when people ask me to do an interview or if I'm going to write something, like, am I going to be as truthful as possible? Am I going to not hold back? And am I going to be the subject that I want my subjects to be? And am I going to be generous with my time, like my subjects have been with their time? Am I going to employ people of color or women on my crew? Because that's what I needed to get my first break. You know, I think that when you're early on in your career, just you're so excited to be there that you forget that this is not all about you. It's about how are you using for your powers for good. And I think that doing all those things and making those small steps will create more empathy in the process. And like, yes, I will start giving my cell phone out to people.
Oh, you do. What was one of the biggest mistakes you made in making your last movie? I like talking about...
Love mistakes.
Yeah, yeah.
When I used to be... I worked for Vice for a long time, and then I was going out in the marketplace and meeting with executives, and I would always ask that during our coffee informationals, like, what was your biggest mistake and how did you solve it?
Oh, wow. And you would do that while you're on the job interview?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't like... They were informationals. Like, so they weren't interviews. Like, hello, I would like to talk to you about you, which people love. And so it's
kind
like...
Kind of like a general...
Yeah,
like, got you.
It doesn't. It's not the sort of like, here's my resume and we're gonna do this. It's sort of more. That's actually how I ended up meeting Andrew Rossi, my producer, who introed me to HBO. Is like, I picked 20 people and I said, I will come to you. It'll be 25 minutes and I have a couple of questions. And that, you know, I get people all the time emailing me and there's no awareness of how to do an ask. And like anybody who's asking or receiving those emails, there's a way to do it where for people to say yes to you. And it says, come to you, 25 minutes, I'll come with questions.
That's so cool.
And I'll buy you a cup of coffee. And that's then like, great. That's, you know, if people know how to say that, then I'll say yes. And so the biggest mistake with the last movie, there's so many.
What's something that you look back on? And I guess it's such an asshole question of me. I mean, you just premiered your film and here you are and I'm asking you about mistakes, but...
No, I love that. I mean, I really would say that we were backstage talking about this and like the first day was one of the biggest mistakes of my life. Like, so to set it up for you, inside courtrooms, there's what's called a pool camera and you're allowed one camera and that's all the news affiliates... will have that footage. And that's how they get it to the local stations. And so it's always like an NBC guy that's the pool camera. And so
always.
It always is. And so then it's just like, I was sort of sneaky and I went to basically the head of comms and I said, I want to be the pool camera. I'm making a 2-part HBO film about this. And the way that I need it to be shot is going to be different than the way the news shoot it. But I will get everything set up. Nothing will be, this will not be a bother to you. And so they awarded us the pool camera position.
And just really quick, that is an extremely hard, whatever you said or did, that's extremely, I've been to a lot of different courtrooms and the independent documentary filmmaker, even if they're with HBO I've never heard of that. It's always NBC because it's Dateline or it's 40, but anyway, continue, sorry.
So I work with Brian Sarkinen, who's my cinematographer. And I let him handle all the technical components because I'm like, oh, I'm thinking about the story and I'm thinking about, you know, what I'm going to make for dinner. And like, he has got this. I don't need to be involved in this. I have no interest in being involved in the technology of this. And so he's like, well, I really prefer if we got this converter box. And I'm like, how much more is it? And he was like, X amount more. And I was like, we don't need it. And he's like, well, I'd really prefer to get these two lenses. They'll be better for that. And then I ask our producer and he's like, no, the lenses we have are fine. No, both of those mistakes were terrible decisions, because the first day of the trial, as it was opening statements, it was not relaying back to the pool cameras. And I think they probably thought about slicing my head off. Like,
right.
They're just like, this is our job. This right. is one of the biggest news stories. And because you bigfooted us and don't know what you're doing, we are suffering.
Right.
And so how I solved that problem, and I felt like a nerve in my head start to snap when it was happening. I just like dripping sweat. It was just very painful, because it had been revealed how, you know, that I had been bigfooted and not paid attention. Mm-hmm. And I turned to a guy, an NBC guy, and I said, I'm really sorry, but I need to fix this. Will you help me? You have no reason to help me.
I love that. You have no reason to help me. No, but seriously, that's it's kind of like saying, please be a human. Please. I mean, I think that's a great way of approaching things.
I need to buy that guy dinner. Like, I need to. So he said, it's probably one of two problems. The second we can't fix now, the first we can. So let's try to fix it. And it was an extension cord issue. And he went and helped us. And like, that guy saved the day. And we were able to relay the feed. They got the feed. And so the next day I came in and we were not fired. We were still able to be the pool camera. And I brought in a big box of donuts that said, I'm sorry, it won't happen again. And of course it happened again a little bit.
And the reason that matters too is, I don't know if it would have been in your case, in your scenario, but I know I've had the experience where if someone else is filming, another company is filming, they have the pool camera, you have to then acquire that footage, and they can make that extremely expensive.
Right.
And so that's why it's not just important in terms of you're able to shoot it the way that you want to, but also that you don't have to go and acquire that footage, which can be awfully expensive. Does anyone have, I know we were going to open it up for some questions.
Hi.
Hey.
I'm in the development phase of a documentary, and I'm getting kind of stonewalled by cops.
Yeah.
That I'm trying to get to open up, even off the record. I think their hesitancy is that it looks like they kind of fucked up. And so I'm wondering if you have any advice in terms of kind of getting them to maybe open up to someone that they absolutely don't want to talk to.
That's a great question. So law enforcement those are the people that have all the information, and they have very little reason to respond to us. What I try to do is I say, I'm making this, and you are going to be in this in terms of what happened, and it behooves you to be the one speaking about it. I think that, you know, I just, there's ways for us to tell that story, but you are the person that knows all the facts, that knows the truth. I will work with your comms department. I will send you the themes. We can have a conversation beforehand. I want to make this as easy as possible for you, but I want to have the right information. And that's what, you know, I need from you going forward. And please think about it as I send the themes. So basically, like, that's my whole job, is like working in stages. And I don't send the questions ahead of time, but if people have the themes, then they feel like, you know, they feel like they know it's coming, and it's not going to be gotcha journalism. And like, you know, you basically, if there's anything that they've talked about in their social media presence, which cops never tend to do, but like what things that they like, if they watch documentaries, I mean, I try to sometimes get some personal sort of flavor in it.
I did one thing once. I don't know. It worked in that scenario. You know, it's always harder to hate up close. And so I went to the town and I pretty much stalked this one officer, met up with him at a diner. You kind of couldn't make it up. And went up to him and said, my name's Andrew. I know this is really weird. I care a lot about something, and if I had 2 minutes of your time, I wonder if we couldn't potentially just talk for another 10 more minutes?
Yeah. So the 2 minutes thing is really important because people think it's 2 hours. You bring the whole camera crew. Yeah. It's like getting people saying, you know, for you being like, it could be 20 minutes. And then, you know, I interviewed somebody like that where she gave me 30 minutes, ended up being an hour and a half.
Right.
So it's like, it's really people that feel like their time is not going to be, but you have to deal with the comms department. Like basically they have a spokesperson. So not only do you have to get through that person to get to that person. So you have to sort of, it's doing both.
And the other thing is that there's definitely no right way. I've tried going through the comms people. I've tried kind of going rogue and finding the officer on my own and convincing him that way. There's a lot of different approaches. Some somehow work, some don't. So hopefully that's somewhat helpful. Yeah.
Going back to what you said earlier about this, the mic is really short. What you said earlier, I can just grab it, about abandonment and kind of feeling like you're using sources. I know in particular myself, like you do have to just go on to your next story, especially if it's a quicker timetable like print media. Do you have a scenario where maybe earlier in your career, you really, really got after a source, tried to become close with them, maybe sat in on something like a dinner, and then down the line, they really needed you? I don't know. The example that stands out to me is like Buzz Bissinger with Friday Night Lights when Boobie Miles got hurt, and then Boobie always kept asking him for money. And I always try not to do that. But do you have anything, maybe just like advice going forward, as other than the cell phone number in that realm?
In terms of staying in contact and feeling like you're doing right by the people that you filmed?
Yeah, not just like, thanks a lot for this story. It won me an award. It got us a lot of clicks, and I've got another thing to do, so sorry.
I mean, I always just think that it's time is valuable, and every minute counts, and I feel like if you're gonna make a living off of someone else's story, then you better find 5 minutes to write them an email or hop on the phone. Otherwise, like, shame on me for not doing that. I'm sure I've filmed, you know, over 50. I'm sure there's been scenarios where I didn't live up to that. Another thing that I've tried to do, if you do win an award, I don't keep them. I send them to the people that I've filmed that if they still like me. And I tend to make projects that are about people at least part of, there's characters in the film that I do. So
to be clear, I've never won an award and I would never give it to anyone else. to be clear.
Well, you have movie posters. I send movie posters to the, I try and give that back to the people. I'm not trying to be too earnest, but to answer the question, I think it's those sorts of things. Cause for them, they fucking love that. Like, that is some cool stuff. I don't know, is there anything
Yeah, I think that I work with people who do that, like have like a wrap gift that is meaningful to the time that they sort of spent together. And then I will send coverage of like, you know, this was written about it. And like I so much appreciate your time. And an example, like for Michelle Carter, I interviewed the journalist Jesse Barron he's a writer for the New York Times Magazine and Esquire. And he is a big reason why the film works, if it works.
He's great.
And so I could have basically taken what I learned from his Esquire piece, put it in VO and put it in my movie. But I am the daughter of a journalist. I'm not a thief. And I wanted him to own his scoops in a way that he could be seen by millions of people. And then I flew him out. I put him on a panel and said, I'm responsible for my person. Like, it's very easy for the director to get sort of attention. But I was like, I want to also give credit to you and the hard work that you did. So I think that documentaries need to start working more in tandem with journalism and stop cherry picking. Like, oh, I read about this piece and I'm going to make a documentary about it now. Yeah, you read about it because a journalist found it. And so I think that I work with Alex Gibney, who's an incredible filmmaker and producer, and his company Jigsaw works with journalists. And he has forever had this amazing, fruitful relationships with Lawrence Wright and Peter Elkin and things like that. And I think that that is a way forward of working with sources, but also working with storytellers.
That's so interesting. You know, I was talking about ego earlier, but I think also, and I was saying this a bit backstage, you're being quite, I mean, it also requires a great deal of humility, which I think you have. I mean, in all of your three films that I've seen, you always feature journalists. And I think that is oftentimes something that's overlooked because people get, there's egos involved and you want to, you know, this is my story and this is how I'm telling it. But I think that's important. Yeah.
Why did you choose a book format for your memoir instead of doing a documentary, considering that's your background?
Yeah, so I have a book coming out next month for Random House called All That You Leave Behind. And it basically, without getting too into the weeds of dark sadness, it's about my dad, journalist David Carr, and the night that he died, which was this very sort of shocking, horrible night. He was interviewing Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden by the way of Skype. And I went back to his friend's house and I started looking at an email he sent me on my 26th birthday. And it was just this incredible, beautiful thing about who I was and who I was going to become. And I felt so truly seen by this person. And so in the year anniversary of his death, I wrote a piece for Medium. It was like what I had learned in the past year. That, you know, grief is not a, you know, grief is ongoing and it's a process and everybody in this room has lost somebody. And so it was me figuring out a year in, what does it mean as a thinker and as a creator? And so Random House actually contacted me and they were like, hey, like, what's up with those emails? This is a book. And I said, you know what? I'm not interested.
It's a good negotiating tactic.
I can't, like, I don't know. Like, I just thought it was going to be, I just was like, I'm a documentary filmmaker and I'm kind of cooking and I'm moving along. And Pamela Cannon, who's my editor, was just like, I think you should do this. And I don't want to like upset the balance in your life, but like there's some really beautiful things in this email. And so then I got, it was the most painful hands down ever in my life to spend 6 hours in my brain writing about my dead father. I don't know. It's just, but I also like meditating on how beautiful and smart and cool and funny he was. And so it is a gift, but it was just like, people contacted me saying, I want to see the doc about your dad. And I just don't know if I could look at that footage. Like watching it would be really hard. So hearing his words, because that was his preferred format, and he wrote this incredible book called The Night of the Gun, which is about he was a former crack addict who went to end up working at the New York Times, and he raised two single baby girls. He was a single dad. Like, I was one of those babies, and it's an incredible story.
You know, I also think, and this is coming from a guy who does documentaries, tell me what you think. It seems like there's documentaries about everyone now. And someone, like another, I'm like, ugh, that person. Like, of course there's a, like, why, I mean, it sounds like your father was this great writer. Why not it be in book form? And I also hate this word, but it's also organic, seeing as there's emails there that would work.
But I mean, just if you're a great documentarian, doesn't make you a great writer. And that was my big fear.
I see.
Just like, you know, films are collaborative, so I get to hide behind the genius of others. And yes, I'm smart and I'm good. I'm here for a reason. I'm not going to be super self-deprecating. Nowhere to hide when you're writing. And so it was, you know, Andrew Rossi, my producing partner and the guy that challenges me, he's like, can you get a ghostwriter? I was like, what? Is my writing bad? What's going on here? And he's just like, yeah, it can't be bad. And I was like, oh, thank you for that feedback. That's a nightmare. And so I sent him a draft and I was like, good or bad, you get to pick.
So you went with Ghostwriter? No, I'm just...
Yes, I did, obviously. No, I'm joking.
So thanks for all the honesty and the forthrightness. How do you decide, with all the input you have on any given film, what the real truth is after all is said and done?
Oh my God. Oh my God, she hit me where it hurts. Yeah. Where is the real truth in this? Can you do
she
it first,
up,
though?
Says it and down.
She
like,
did it with
like
a scarf
that.
On. She yeah, like, you know, made sure that we
monotone,
like she announced herself.
Yeah, what is the truth?
That's for you.
I can't answer. I mean, I know one thing to be true. If I go in to a project or a story, and this is where documentaries and scripted, I think, are very different. If I go into a project, a documentary, and I think this is the story. And I have that idea. And that's why I'm excited about it. And then 8 months later, a year later, 2 years later, I'm premiering that documentary. And it's up on the big screen. If the story I'm telling up there on the big screen is the same story that I thought it would be in that very beginning, then it means I wasn't listening in between and I didn't do a good job of finding the truth in whatever form that may take.
Yeah, like if it doesn't change, you haven't found the truth.
That would be my only inkling towards an answer, because I think documentaries fundamentally are about listening.
Well, storytelling, podcasts, written pieces. I mean, you talk to the primary sources and then you fact check. I think that it's also very easy to get to fall in love with your own thesis. And so you have to play like mental chess against what is the position against this thesis and how would one argue that? And so that's what I try to do. And that's ultimately like, what Michelle Carter is. It's me being like, this is the prosecution, what they said, and this is the defense.
Yeah.
And so that's what you do with anything, not just a doc. It's just like, that's great. But also like Leaving Neverland was not that. It was one side of the story, the Michael Jackson HBO project, which is, and I thought that was actually really cool and fascinating and like showed a radical opinion or movement towards acceptance. Mm. Like we are just going to listen to the survivors of Michael Jackson. And it's not an investigative, like super like going to the trial, because that story has been told. And so I think that there's moments when absolute truth is really important and we're striving for truth, but there's also like there's sometimes we just have enough room to really dive into this version.
I think we have time for a couple, maybe one or two more. Yes, sir.
Do you ever feel like when you're creating, especially if you're on a roll where you just keep on doing things, like you get overwhelmed and like almost like the voice, because I know as a creator, there's that voice inside that always says I suck. And so do you feel like that voice comes at you, especially in the darker times with the stuff that you do? How do you deal with that? And what's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, the inner critic stuff is crazy. I mean, it's really like, well, my movie won't be as good as my last movie. I don't know how to write a book. I don't know how to to look for another story. I feel totally at capacity. I think that the way to combat that is not to say what I already said, but like really open and look at other things and be consuming other media and, you know, really be thinking, what did I love about that? What did that teach me? Helping another person, calling somebody in your life that just saying, you know what, I was really thinking about you. I think as like in the age of social media and branding and like, we're all sort of so stuck on who we are and what we have to accomplish that we forget about like we were put on this earth to take care of each other. And so like last night after a long, long day, you know, I really wanted to call and talk about South By with someone. And I said, I called my friend and I was like, you know, I just, you know, I wanted to call and check in. I had a feeling that I needed to talk to you. And she's like, how did you know? We didn't talk about South By because we didn't need to talk about South By. I talked about South By with the internet. I needed to call and have a conversation. At the end of it, I felt good because I like helped somebody and I listened to them. And it wasn't about the story and it wasn't about the jail or the logistics or anything. And so it's just like, we can't forget to be humans.
I think for any project I've ever worked on, if you don't think you're failing at a certain point, it's probably not worth it. Every project I've ever worked on at a certain point, I don't know about you, I am like, shit, I have nothing. Footage sucks. I suck. This, and I'm being serious. Like,
I've never felt that way.
And you go down a pretty dark place, and then I realize it's you need that if it's going to be worth it. For me, I know a project is good when people start telling me no. You're like, you can't get access to that. I'm like, maybe I'm onto something then. If life is a series of green lights, then you know, might as well do something else. We might have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
So both of y'all do a lot of work with like crime stories, and nowadays it feels like there are just hundreds out there to pick from. How do you go about finding a good like starting point on a story that you want to do work on? Like, how do you find something that really interests you to like inspire you to make a whole movie about it?
I think that for me, it's a crime story, or if it taps into a larger societal issue, like today with the college admission scandal and the celebrities that were implicated, that is about, I feel entitled to get my kid into school because I'm famous. What if there's some like sort of cover up? And so if my mind starts to do that thing where it's like, well, it's this and it's this and it's this, and I keep going. And then it's also like, if I'm like, so I have a series of friends, I cold pitch to them and I'm like, is this interesting? Like, you know, having a group of people to be like, you know, that's interesting, or no, that bores me to tears. I think it has to, crime stories have to say something about the greater society for them to tap into any sort of zeitgeist, because we're living in an age of, you guys have all, everything in the world available you to watch. Why are you going to watch this thing? If you don't have HBO, why are you going to watch it? Are you going to watch it on iTunes? Like, there's so much choice here. As creators, you have to be like, why is somebody going to sit down and watch this? And then as you're making it, factoring that in.
Something that's interesting I find is that with documentaries, people, the public, are doing a lot of the work for us. And by that, I mean, with the movie I made about Ryan Ferguson, the moment he was arrested when he was 19, he was put in a cop car, it was being filmed. He goes into the interrogation room, it was being filmed. Court, being filmed. The whole sequence, almost, was filmed. So on a very practical level, there's a lot of stories that I would love to do. I know one thing that helps when it comes to trying to get it made is we actually already have half of it shot, in terms of trying to convince other people why it should be made.
Yeah, because distributors care about that. They care when you're going into a room and pitching, which is what I do with a majority of my time. It's saying it's this meets this, and I pick two successful things, so they have an understanding of, okay, well, if I buy this, there's going to be an embedded audience in it. And I think that it's really about like exclusive access to archival people that are going to talk to you that you've already had a conversation with, you might not even be making the movie yet, and you can say that you reached out and you're in contact. So I think that there's like a definite language when it comes to like getting on the path to green.
So I just want to thank South by Southwest for having us here. I want to thank Cadence 13, who produces this podcast, and everyone at Cadence 13, Josephina, Pam, Sean, Kurt's here, Chris, 7 Bucks Productions. I know Kevin's here. And most of all, I want to thank Aaron for the
film. Most of all, I want to thank you guys for hanging out in this audience and like in this auditorium and talking about darkness. This was great questions.
Yeah, they were.
Can we clap for him too?
No.
He's great.
Thank you, Aaron.
The longest hair in the game.
I want to again thank Aaron Lee Carr, and we'll be having so many more fascinating guests coming. As always, it'd be great. It'd be really appreciated if you go on Apple Podcasts and give us a review, or give us 5 stars, or if you don't really like this show, then you can totally not do any of that. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram at Andrew Jenks. I also want to give a special shout out to Bill, our man, Skinny Bill, who recently had his 25th birthday. I'll see you next week.